So hi everyone, welcome to the podcast. So super stoked to announce that we have Shreya of the Council Cap here on the podcast today. So hi Shreya, could you firstly share a bit more about what is the Council Cap and the investment thesis, and how exactly did you get involved in the amazing work that the Council Cap is doing?
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me here. So a little bit more about the council. So we have basically two pieces of the council. We have the Council Capital, which is a pre-seed venture fund, and then we have the Council Angels, which is an angel investor community. So the pre-seed fund is a debut fund led by GP Amber Illig. Amber's background is really great. She's been an operator at a lot of different large companies to startups. So Apple, Snap, Cruise, Atmos, and started off her career at Eli Lilly. And I joined the team full-time 4 months ago, but have been in touch with Amber for a couple of years. It actually started with the angel investor community. So the angel community began in 2019 in San Francisco, and it was just all female operator angels helping each other invest together, learn more, and get more women on cap tables actively investing. And the fund was raised on top of the momentum of the angel community. So the angel community is still around. We grew from 10 to about 100, and we're actively recruiting more members. And then the pre-seed fund has invested in 15 companies so far, hopefully 15 more incoming soon. So that's our goal.
So that's amazing that you're trying to onboard more women to participate in angel investing. And so how exactly did you get your break into angel investing? And what are some top tips you could share today for someone who wants to get into angel investing and start, you know, tapping into this potentially lucrative industry?
Absolutely. Yeah. So I do want to say, like, as a caveat to everything, I think that angel investing, I mean, everybody says that it's incredibly high risk. So the goal is that a high risk, high reward, and that you ideally have some kind of mega hit in your portfolio, an Uber, an Airbnb, a Dropbox, something that goes like 30x, 50x, 100x the amount that you put in. But in reality, because the vast majority of startups fail, there is a chance that you will angel invest in many companies and they won't be hits. So I only started a year and a half ago. It takes 7, 10, or even more years for companies to see some kind of exit, which is an acquisition or an IPO. And so I don't really know yet. And I'm just going to actively do this. I'm kind of going to assume that I'm treating them less as investments and more like I'm just spending money, frankly. And I think of them as my way to learn and strengthen my own brand and relationships and knowledge in the startup world and in the tech industry. But I don't really think of them as like, oh, some of these are going to be mega hits. Obviously, I try to only angel invest in companies where I really believe in the founders, the market, and the product. But that said, it's so, so high risk that there's reasons that the accreditation rules have been around for so long. They're changing now. They're making it so that there's an exam that everyone can take so that you can just become a knowledgeable investor. And it's not just based on your income or net worth. But I don't think that this is something that people should rush into doing. Make sure that you've already been in the industry, you've had startup roles and jobs, you're financially comfortable, and then you're setting aside capital to angel invest. I've learned a ton from Elizabeth Yin from Hustle Fund. She's tweeted so much and blogged a lot about angel investing, getting started, investing in general, the mindsets, the capital, all kinds of things. Those were incredibly valuable to me. When I met Amber Illig 2 years ago from the council, we had a bunch of really frank conversations that also really helped me feel like, okay, I've been leading founder communities for 7 or 8 years. I've seen thousands of founders, and I feel really confident that I will be able to start angel investing and kind of figure it out and know what I'm doing. So another thing to note is that I have started with the absolute smallest check size. So AngelList only allows a $1,000 minimum check size into companies, and that is my standard check size. So I'm not investing more in any companies until I have a lot more cash. And I'm only investing a really small percentage of my overall investment to net worth. Everything else is in much safer things like index funds and ETFs and just like a savings account and other things like that. So it's only about 5% or less. And I'm also making sure to diversify. And so investing in about 8 to 10 companies per year consistently over many years.
Yeah, that's great that you've just started angel investing, so this is kind of like a new domain for you. So, and you also said you started with the smallest check size. So my question to you is, so how can, as a small like check size investor, how can you be of value add to your founders? Like anything that you could share for somebody that also wants to start investing like small check sizes?
Yeah, I think I would definitely recommend that like you have to feel confident that you would be able to help these companies as an advisor or as an investor and supporter, because your cash is not going to fill up their round. So let's say a founder is trying to raise $500,000, 750K, 1 million. Obviously, the 1,000 makes almost no difference. So I'm not, my primary value add is not my money. If I had a larger check size, then that could be a big piece of my value add where I said, oh, I get you 20% closer to filling up your fundraising round. Then the founder's actually like, okay, yes, this capital will help me do something that other people couldn't help me do. But for me, it's not really the capital. It's really about my own like network building and knowledge building. And so I make myself available to everyone that I've angel invested in. So it's really about me being responsive to any of their inbound messages, outbound, asking them anything that I can help with, making introductions to investors in the round that I invest in to help them fill that, and in introductions to investors in later rounds, connections to customers, strategic feedback and advice based on the jobs that I've had. So every founder, of course, like no founder is able to be an expert in everything. And so I think that your small check angels and advisors can be really helpful, filling in all those blind spots in the jobs that you haven't had.
Yeah, that's, I think my biggest takeaway out of all that was, even if you're a small check investor, you should also be helping them to make intros to other investors and have a real like connection to them as well, like just to help them out and be like as helpful and as serviceful as you can for them. And so my next question to you is, so could you share a bit about your upcoming story and your background? And I noticed you had quite a phenomenal like journey from like on deck to like Vital Society, now your own startup, and also on and also now the Council Cap. So could you just share a bit about like what you've got going on and anything the audience can like stay tuned or look out for?
Yeah, so I've been in the startup world for about 10 years. I started about halfway through undergrad and college. I went to Tufts University outside of Boston. It's not a typical startup and tech target school. So there's a very popular computer science program, but at the time that I was in it, which was 2010 to 2015, a lot of the people who studied computer science were more focused on going into research or joining big tech like Google, Facebook. And I didn't want to do that. And so I had to learn a lot on my own to get into startups and learn about startups. And I basically just went on the train constantly to go downtown to Northeastern, BU, Harvard, of course, MIT, of course, and go to events that they were posting. And then also like General Assembly Boston, Microsoft had this like event space, the Nerd Center, that where they had a bunch of events. I would go to hackathons. And I was trying to figure out where's my place in the industry because I realized very early on that it wasn't going to be in research or big tech. And so then when I discovered the world of startups through those events, I was really intrigued and excited, got super involved in the hackathon scene, and basically just focused much more on this professional development on the side of my work than my academics, for the whole second half of college. And then I moved to the Bay Area, worked at a few really small startups because I wanted to wear a lot of hats and I wanted to understand what it would take to be a founder by being up close and personal with the founders. And I still think that that was a great move, but I did kind of make my life harder because I didn't like chase after brand name companies. So my resume looked like these random places that most people hadn't heard of. I didn't get to have like a Twitter or any other like well-known brand name on my resume. So I think that for a few years, I felt this like chip on my shoulder where I felt like I had to prove myself and prove that I was actually a talented and a great employee. And I started off in like community and operations roles. But I had studied computer science, but I knew that I wasn't a great software engineer. Then I felt like, okay, maybe I just need to suck it up and be a software engineer. Otherwise, I don't know where my career will go. And I wasn't sure that I was building long-term sustainable skills. So I actually went back to a coding boot camp in 2017, Rhythm School. Rhythm is fantastic. Highly recommend it. And then I joined a company called Glider and got to be a UX engineer and PM. I still think that that was a very valuable experience so that I could understand through personal hands-on work what it took to be on the engineering team and products team. And to this day, that helps me when I'm assessing and evaluating companies as an investor. But it really isn't where my deepest passion lies. So I kept going back to founder communities, and I relaunched the Violet Society, which I had started in college, on the side of that job as an engineer and PM.
Yeah, so you had quite the career path and pivot from like computer science to now running your own community and also doing like a bunch of amazing things with the Council Cap. So my next question to you is, so what are some of the key learnings that you've had building your new company? So I understand that you might that you have a company that's either in stealth or it's already been publicly announced. I'm not too sure about that yet. But yeah, if you could share like any of your key learnings as a founder, that would be amazing.
So I was working on a startup idea in January and February, and I actually set it aside to join the council. So I'm no longer working on a company, but really what it was going to be is, I continually revisit like the idea of founder communities that are really powerful. And I'm always trying to look for opportunities in that space and trying to figure out what is, how founders are not being served by existing organizations. So after Violet Society, I was running these like cohorts for early stage founders pretty much on my own. I had friends who were volunteer helping, but I was doing it full time. And then when I joined the OnDeck team, I got to see what it took to really scale up those communities. I worked on the founder program, job seeker program, and then Catalyst, which was for early career people. And that I feel like was an amazing training grounds to really scale up and see like what it took to build a super, super valuable community. And that led into me trying to figure out, okay, where is there still white space? And now I'm kind of still flexing those community skills by working on the Council Angels. So although it's not a founder community, we are helping founders every single week by connecting them to angel investors. And the angels members that join us, many of them are high up employees and operators themselves. They're senior in their careers or they're founders. And they want to give back to their other founder friends because they're now seed or series A stage. And they have a little bit of capital to start investing in others. So I think that there's a lot of work to be done to open up the world of startups to more and more people. And so I always like to be working on some piece of the pie, whether it's the founders, the investors, the job seekers, and like opening up access to more talented people.
So you'd mentioned lastly that you wanted to open up access to startups and VCs to a broader range of people. So in your opinion, like how would you go about doing that currently? Like, What does it take to be more inclusive in this domain and this region of industry?
Yeah, so I have a lot of opinions on what I think doesn't really work. So I've seen a lot of communities that are fully open to anyone, and those get drowned out in like noise very fast. So if somebody, for example, says like, "Oh, I'm going to start a women in tech Slack community," and they just make it very general like that. They let anybody sign up. There's no applications or admissions. And then they say, "Oh, I grew this to 2,000 people in a year." Sure, you did. But it often ends up becoming a big group of people who don't really know what they're doing, all talking to each other, because the people who are truly experienced in the industry and could be helpful mentors, they quickly leave because they're not finding it that valuable and they're just getting kind of spammed with inbound from others. So what I like to do is I like to run programs that are open application, so anyone can join. They're not invite only. There's quite a few organizations in the startup world that are invite only. And I think that has its place, but I like to do things that are open application. But there's always an admissions process. And the reason that there's always an admissions process is because I like to talk to people and understand, yes, you might have an unconventional background, but are you still actually a fit for this network? are you going to get out of it what we expect you to get out of it? And will you be able to get back what other members often are able to give back? Are you really aligned with what the purpose of this is? So during Violet Society, I would assess sometimes, we were an organization for very early career, or not early career, but very early stage founders. So people would come with maybe just an idea. I would try and assess in the interviews, are they actually going to build this idea or any idea in the next 6 months? Or are they the kind of person who just likes to call themselves a founder because it sounds cool? And there were quite a few of those, frankly. And so I don't think that it actually helps inclusion or equity to have like large, open, general organizations. I think that you need to have some kind of selection process. But then in that selection process, try to minimize personal biases. Don't go by people's fancy brand names or resumes, but try and assess their actual skill, their grit, their potential, and their interest in growing.
Yeah, I think those last few points were really key about assessing their skills over their resume. And I'm a really firm believer in that as well. Like proof of work, skills, and like those are more important to me than resumes. And so my last question to you is, so what has it been like running workshops and hosting events? So what exactly does it take to build such a great event and build like a beloved community around that event?
Yeah, I love hosting virtual events. I got a ton of experience during OnDeck in COVID because we were doing maybe 7 or 8 events per week for a year and a half to 2 years of lockdown. So people were really available. They were really hungry to learn. They were hungry for community. It was kind of the perfect storm situation, even though it was under the backdrop of something pretty tragic and frustrating as a full society. So what I like to do in a virtual event is have a very clear idea of what people will get out of it. Prepare if it's a speaker event, an interview, or a workshop. Do a pre-call with people beforehand. I often like to use slides. When I do interview style, we try and give it some structure by having attendees like write questions in a Zoom chat and then upvote each other's questions, or we use a tool like Slido to do those upvotes. And then I like to play music at the beginning. I don't remember who I first saw this from, but I thought it was brilliant when I saw it. Borrowed that, and now I'm a huge evangelist of telling everyone, like, okay, never do the people join in complete silence and you just say, hey, thanks for coming. Hey, it's so awkward. It's like everyone gets uncomfortable. People want to leave. And so I just play fun hype up music. It feels like a party. People get excited. They pay attention. And then I like to make the events like a really curated 45 minutes of back and forth, 15 minutes Q&A, thank people after, send out links and recordings, and ensure that we keep in touch. And so I love doing events as a way to share knowledge and share experience, but it's not going to build those really strong, intimate connections. And so whenever I'm running a community, I balance those out, those one-to-many events with one-on-ones. And I try to personally talk one-on-one over Zoom or in person for coffee with as many members as I possibly can. And that's been able to work so far because I haven't really worked on absolutely gigantic communities. The biggest was Catalyst, had 200 members every 3 months. And I had two full-time teammates and one part-time teammate. And so we would split up the one-on-ones to ensure that every member could talk to at least one person on the team.
Yeah, that's really great that you mentioned about one-on-ones and having that kind of personal connection with your community members. And that's also a great way to do things that that are scrappy also as well, like just like doing things scrappily. And yeah, so it was an absolute honor and a pleasure to host you in the podcast today. So do share how the audience can get in touch with you. And also secondly, how they can pitch to the Council CAP. And thirdly, maybe even how they can get involved with the work that you're doing at Council CAP.
Thank you so much. I'm very easy to find. So my full name is Shriya Navadia. You can find me easily on Twitter and LinkedIn. Happy to add people on either of those. And then I don't mind connection requests on LinkedIn from people I haven't met before, but I would love a little message with it. On LinkedIn, you can also see the links for every way to get involved in the council. So how to pitch us if you're a founder, how to invest in the fund if you're a limited partner, and how to apply to join the angel community if you're an angel investor. So our website is also thecouncil.co, so not .com, but .co, and it's just the council, no spaces.
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing all your insights. I know the audience is going to learn a ton from you about everything that you've been sharing today about angel investing and other topics. So yeah, thank you so much for coming on once again.
Thank you.
So if you're listening to this podcast right now, I have an open opportunity to reach this audience. So if you want to reach college students and freshers interested in startups and venture capital, and just in terms of the demographics, the age of 18 to 22 is the highest age demographic in India, and US are the two largest country demographics of listeners for this podcast. Email me at bizpodruhi@gmail.com. So thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode, and hope you've learned something new.